up very much invited at the temporary hospital, and flinched at the smell. A man with a bandaged hand was telling the mute, shock-faced soldier that he would survive.
"You'll soon be going home," he assured him.
"Yes, home," I thought, "for good."
"I'll wait for you," he continued. "I was going back at the end of the week, but I'll wait."
In the middle of his brother's next sentence, I gathered up the soul of Robert Holtzapfel. Usually, I need to exert myself to look through the ceiling when I'm inside, but I was lucky in that particular building. A small section of the roof had been destroyed, and I could see straight up. A meter away, Michael Holtzapfel was still talking. I tried to ignore him by watching the hole above me. The sky was white, but deteriorating fast. As always, it was becoming an enormous drop sheet. Blood was bleeding through, and in patches the clouds were dirty, like footprints in melting snow. Footprints, you ask? Well, I wonder whose those could be. In Frau Holtzapfel's kitchen, Liesel read. The pages waded by unheard, and for me, when the Russian scenery fades in my eyes, the snow refuses to stop falling from the ceiling. The kettle is covered, as is the table. The humans, too, are wearing patches of snow on their heads and shoulders. The brother shivers. The woman weeps. And the girl goes on reading, for that's why she's there. And it feels good to be good for something in the aftermath of the snows of Stalingrad. The Ageless Brother. Liesel Memminger was a few weeks short of 14. Her papa was still away. She'd completed 3 more reading sessions with a devastated woman. On many nights, she'd watched Rosa sit with the accordion and pray with her chin on top of the bellows. Now she thought, it's time. Usually it was stealing that cheered her up, but on this day, it was giving something back. She reached under her bed and removed the plate. As quickly as she could, she cleaned it in the kitchen and made her way out. It felt nice to be walking up through Mulking. The air was sharp and flat, like the Watschen of a sadistic teacher or nun. Her shoes were the only sound on Munich Street. As she crossed the river, a rumour of sunshine stood behind the clouds. At 8 Granderstrasse, she walked up the steps, left the plate by the front door, and knocked. And by the time the door was opened, the girl was around the corner. Liesel did not look back, but she knew that if she did, she'd have found her brother at the bottom of the steps again, his knee completely healed. She could even hear his voice.
"That's better, Liesel."
It was with great sadness that she realized that her brother would be 6 forever. But when she held that thought, she also made an effort to smile. She remained at the Amper River, at the bridge, where Papa used to stand and lean. She smiled and smiled, and when it all came out, she walked home, and her brother never climbed into her sleep again. In many ways, she would miss him, but she could never miss his deadly eyes on the floor of the train, or the sound of a cough that killed. The book thief lay in bed that night, and the boy only came before she closed her eyes. He was one member of a caste, for Liesel was always visited in that room. Her papa stood and called her half a woman. Max was writing the word shaker in the corner. Rudy was naked by the door. Occasionally, her mother stood on a bedside train platform. And far away, in the room that stretched like a bridge to a nameless town, her brother, Werner, played in the cemetery snow. From down the hall, like a metronome for the visions, Rosa snored, and Liesel lay awake, surrounded, but also remembering a quote from her most recent book. The Last Human Stranger, page 38. There were people everywhere on the city street, but the stranger could not have been more alone if it were empty. When morning came, the visions were gone, and she could hear the quiet recital of words in the living room. Rosa was sitting with the accordion, praying. "Make them come back alive," she repeated. "Please, Lord, please, all of them." Even the wrinkles around her eyes were joining hands. The accordion must have ached her, but she remained. Rosa would never tell Hans about these moments, but Liesl believed that it must have been those prayers that helped Papa survive the LSE's accident in Essen. If they didn't help, they certainly can't have hurt. The accident. It was a surprisingly clear afternoon, and the men were climbing into the truck. Hans Hubermann had just sat down in his appointed seat. Reinhold Zucker was standing above him. "Move it," he said.
"Bitte? Excuse me?"
Zucker was hunched beneath the vehicle's ceiling. "I said move it, Arschloch!" The greasy jungle of his fringe fell in clumps onto his forehead. "I'm swapping seats with you." Hans was confused. The back seat was probably the most uncomfortable of the lot. It was the draftiest, the coldest.
"Why?"
"Does it matter?" Zucker was losing patience. "Maybe I want to get off first to use the shithouse." Hans was quickly aware that the rest of the unit was already watching this pitiful struggle between two supposed grown men. He didn't want to lose, but he didn't want to be petty either. Also, they'd just finished a tiring shift, and he didn't have the energy to go on with it. Bent-backed, he made his way forward to the vacant seat in the middle of the truck.
"Why did you give in to that Scheißkopf?" the man next to him asked.
Hans lit a match and offered a share of the cigarette.
"The draft back there goes straight through my ears."
The olive-green truck was on its way toward the camp, maybe 10 miles away. Brunnenweg was telling a joke about a French waitress when the left front wheel was punctured and the driver lost control. The vehicle rolled many times, and the men swore as they tumbled with the air, the light, the trash, and the tobacco. Outside, the blue sky changed from ceiling to floor as they clambered for something to hold. When it stopped, they were all crowded onto the right-hand wall of the truck, their faces wedged against the filthy uniform next to them. Questions of health were passed around, until one of the men, Eddie Alma, started shouting, "Get this bastard off me!" He said it 3 times, fast. He was staring into Reinhold Zucker's blinkless eyes. The damage. Essen. 6 men burned by cigarettes. 2 broken hands, 7 broken fingers. A broken leg for Hans Hubermann. A broken neck for Reinhold Zucker. Snapped almost in line with his earlobes. They dragged each other out until only the corpse was left in the truck. The driver, Helmut Broman, was sitting on the ground scratching his head.
"The tire," he explained. "It just blew."
Some of the men sat with him and echoed that it wasn't his fault. Others walked around smoking, asking each other if they thought their injuries were bad enough to be relieved of duty. Another small group gathered at the back of the truck and viewed the body. Over by a tree, a thin strip of intense pain was still opening in Hans Hubermann's leg.
"It should have been me," he said.
"What?" the sergeant called over from the truck.
"He was sitting in my seat."
Helmut Broman regained his senses and climbed back into the driver's compartment. Sideways, he tried to start the engine, but there was no kicking it over. Another truck was sent for, as was an ambulance. The ambulance didn't come.
"You know what that means, don't you?" said Boris Schipper.
They did. When they resumed the trip back to camp, each man tried not to look down at Reinhold Zucker's open-mouthed sneer.
"I told you we should have turned him face down," someone mentioned.
A few times, some of them simply forgot and rested their feet on the body. Once they arrived, they all tried to avoid the task of pulling him out. When the job was done, Hans Hubermann took a few abbreviated steps before the pain fractured in his leg and brought him down. An hour later, when the doctor examined him, he was told it was definitely broken. The sergeant was on hand and stood with half a grin.
"Well, Huberman, looks like you've got away with it, doesn't it?"
He was shaking his round face, smoking, and he provided a list of what would happen next.
"You'll rest up. They'll ask me what we should do with you. I'll tell them you did a great job."
He blew some more smoke.
"And I think I'll tell them you're not fit for the LSE anymore, and you should be sent back to Munich to work in an office or do whatever cleaning up needs doing there. How does that sound?"
Unable to resist a laugh within the grimace of pain, Hans replied,
"It sounds good, Sergeant."
Boris Schipper finished his cigarette.
"Damn right it sounds good. You're lucky I like you, Huberman. You're lucky you're a good man and generous with the cigarettes."
In the next room, they were making up the plaster. The Bitter Taste of Questions. Just over a week after Liesl's birthday in mid-February, she and Rosa finally received a detailed letter from Hans Huberman. She ran inside from the mailbox and showed it to Mama. Rosa made her read it aloud, and they could not contain their excitement when Liesl read about his broken leg. She was stunned to the extent that she mouthed the next sentence only to herself.
"What is it?"
Rosa pushed.
"Saumensch!"
Liesl looked up from the letter and was close to shouting. The sergeant had been true to his word.
"He's coming home, Mama! Papa's coming home!"
They embraced in the kitchen, and the letter was crushed between their bodies. A broken leg was certainly something to celebrate. When Liesl took the news next door, Barbara Steiner was ecstatic. She rubbed the girl's arms and called out to the rest of her family. In their kitchen, the household of Steiner seemed buoyed by the news that Hans Huberman was returning home. Rudy smiled and laughed, and Liesl could see that he was at least trying. However, she could also sense the bitter taste of questions in his mouth. Why him? Why Hans Huberman and not Alex Steiner? He had a point. One toolbox, one bleeder, one bear. Since his father's recruitment to the army the previous October, Rudy's anger had been growing nicely. The news of Hans Huberman's return was all he needed to take it a few steps further. He did not tell Liesl about it. There was no complaining that it wasn't fair. His decision was to act. He carried a metal case up Himmel Street at the typical thieving time of darkening afternoon. Rudy's toolbox. It was patchy red and the length of an oversized shoebox. It contained the following. Rusty pocket knife, times one. Small flashlight, times one. Hammer, times two. One medium, one small. Hand towel, times one. Screwdriver, times three. Varying in size. Ski mask, times one. Clean socks, times one. Teddy bear, times one. Liesl saw him from the kitchen window, his purposeful steps and committed face, exactly like the day he'd gone to find his father. He gripped the handle with as much force as he could, and his movements were stiff with rage. The book thief dropped the towel she was holding and replaced it with a single thought. He's going stealing. She ran out to meet him. There was not even the semblance of a hello. Rudy simply continued walking and spoke through the cold air in front of him. Close to Tommy Muller's apartment block, he said,
"You know something, Liesl? I was thinking. You're not a thief at all."
And he didn't give her a chance to reply.
"That woman lets you in. She even leaves you cookies, for Christ's sake. I don't call that stealing. Stealing is what the army does, taking your father and mine."
He kicked a stone, and it clanged against a gate. He walked faster.
"All those rich Nazis up there on Grandestraße, Gelbstraße, Heiderstraße."
Liesl could concentrate on nothing but keeping up. They'd already passed Frau Diller's and were well onto Munich Street.
"Rudy, how does it feel anyway?"
"How does what feel?"
"When you take one of those books."
At that moment, she chose to keep still. If he wanted an answer, he'd have to come back. and he did. Well? But again it was Rudy who answered, before Liesel could even open her mouth.
It feels good, doesn't it, to steal something back?
Liesel forced her attention to the toolbox, trying to slow him down.
What have you got in there?
He bent over and opened it up. Everything appeared to make sense, but the teddy bear. As they kept walking, Rudy explained the toolbox at length and what he would do with each item. For example, the hammers were for smashing windows, and the towel was to wrap them up to quell the sound.
And the teddy bear?
It belonged to Anna Marie Steiner and was no bigger than one of Liesel's books. The fur was shaggy and worn. The eyes and ears had been sewn back on repeatedly, but it was friendly looking nonetheless.
That, answered Rudy, is the one masterstroke. That's if a kid walks in while I'm inside. I'll give it to them to calm down. And what do you plan to steal?
He shrugged. Money, food, jewelry, whatever I can get my hands on. It sounded simple enough. It wasn't until 15 minutes later, when Liesel watched the sudden silence on his face, that she realized Rudy Steiner wasn't stealing anything. The commitment had disappeared, and although he still watched the imagined glory of stealing, she could see that now he was not believing it. He was trying to believe it, and that's never a good sign. His criminal greatness was unfurling before his eyes, and as the footsteps slowed and they watched the houses, Liesel's relief was pure and sad inside her. It was Gelbstrasse. On the whole, the houses sat dark and huge. Rudy took off his shoes and held them with his left hand. He held the toolkit with his right. Between the clouds there was a moon, perhaps a mile of light.
"What am I waiting for?" he asked.
But Liesel didn't reply. Again Rudy opened his mouth, but without any words. He placed the toolbox on the ground and sat on it. His socks grew cold and wet.
"Lucky there's another pair in the toolbox," Liesel suggested,
and she could see him trying not to laugh, despite himself. Rudy moved across and faced the other way, and there was room for Liesel now as well. The book thief and her best friend sat back to back on a patchy red toolbox in the middle of the street. Each facing a different way, they remained for quite a while. When they stood up and went home, Rudy changed his socks and left the previous ones on the road. A gift, he decided, for Gelbstrasse. The Spoken Truth of Rudy Steiner.
I guess I'm better at leaving things behind than stealing them.
A few weeks later, the toolbox ended up being good for at least something. Rudy cleared it of screwdrivers and hammers, and chose instead to store in it many of the Steiners' valuables for the next air raid. The only item that remained was the teddy bear. On March the 9th, Rudy exited the house with it when the sirens made their presence felt again in Malking. While the Steiners rushed down Himmel Street, Michael Holzapfel was knocking furiously at Rosa Huberman's door. When she and Liesel came out, he handed them his problem. "My mother," he said, and the plums of blood were still on his bandage. "She won't come out. She's sitting at the kitchen table." As the weeks had worn on, Frau Holzapfel had not yet begun to recover. When Liesel came to read, the woman spent most of the time staring at the window. Her words were quiet, close to motionless. All brutality and reprimand were wrested from her face. It was usually Michael who said goodbye to Liesel, or gave her the coffee and thanked her. Now this. Rosa moved into action. She waddled swiftly through the gate and stood in the open doorway.
"Holzapfel!"
There was nothing but sirens and Rosa.
"Holzapfel, get out here, you miserable old swine!"
Tact had never been Rosa Huberman's strong point.
"If you don't come out, we're all going to die here on the street."
She turned and viewed the helpless figures on the footpath. A siren had just finished wailing.
"What now?"
Michael shrugged, disoriented, perplexed. Liesel dropped her bag of books and faced him. She shouted at the commencement of the next siren.
Can I go in?
But she didn't wait for the answer. She ran the short distance of the path and shoved past Mama. Frau Holzapfel was unmoved at the table.
What do I say? Liesel thought. How do I get her to move?
When the sirens took another breath, she heard Rosa calling out,
Just leave her, Liesel. We have to go. If she wants to die, that's her business.
But then the sirens resumed. They reached down and tossed the voice away. Now it was only noise and girl and wiry woman.
Frau Holzapfel, please.
Much like her conversation with Ilse Hermann on the day of the cookies, a multitude of words and sentences were at her fingertips. The difference was that today there were bombs. Today it was slightly more urgent. The options.
Frau Holzapfel, we have to go. Frau Holzapfel, we'll die if we stay here. You still have one son left. Everyone's waiting for you. The bombs will blow your head off. If you don't come, I'll stop coming to read to you. And that means you've lost your only friend.
She went with the last sentence, calling the words directly through the sirens. Her hands were planted on the table. The woman looked up and made her decision. She didn't move. Liesel left. She withdrew herself from the table and rushed from the house. Rosa held open the gate, and they started running to number 45. Michael Holzapfel remained stranded on Himmel Street.
Come on,
Rosa implored him, but the returned soldier hesitated. He was just about to make his way back inside when something turned him around. His mutilated hand was the only thing attached to the gate, and shamefully he dragged it free and followed. They all looked back several times, but there was still no Frau Holzapfel. The road seemed so wide, and when the final siren evaporated into the air, the last three people on Himmel Street made their way into the Fiedler's basement.
"What took you so long?"
Rudy asked. He was holding the toolbox. Liesel placed her bag of books on the ground and sat on them.
"We were trying to get Frau Holzapfel."
Rudy looked around.
"Where is she?"
"At home, in the kitchen."
In the far corner of the shelter, Michael was cramped and shivery.
"I should have stayed," he said. "I should have stayed. I should have stayed."
His voice was close to noiseless, but his eyes were louder than ever. They beat furiously in their sockets as he squeezed his injured hand and the blood rose through the bandage. It was Rosa who stopped him.
"Please, Michael, it's not your fault."
But the young man with only a few remaining fingers on his right hand was inconsolable. He crouched in Rosa's eyes.
"Tell me something," he said, "because I don't understand."
He fell back and sat against the wall.
"Tell me, Rosa, how can she sit there ready to die while I still want to live?"
The blood thickened.
"Why do I want to live? I shouldn't want to, but I do."
The young man wept uncontrollably, with Rosa's hand on his shoulder for many minutes. The rest of the people watched. He could not make himself stop, even when the basement door opened and shut, and Frau Holzapfel entered the shelter. Her son looked up. Rosa stepped away. When they came together, Michael apologized.
"Mama, I'm sorry. I should have stayed with you."
Frau Holzapfel didn't hear. She only sat with her son and lifted his bandaged hand.
"You're bleeding again," she said.
And with everyone else, they sat and waited. Liesel reached into her bag and rummaged through the books. The bombing of Munich, March the 9th and 10th. The night was long with bombs and reading. Her mouth was dry, but the book thief worked through 54 pages. The majority of children slept and didn't hear the sirens of renewed safety. Their parents woke them or carried them up the basement steps into the world of darkness. Far away, fires were burning, and I had picked up just over 200 murdered souls.
I was on my way to Malking for one more.
Himmel Street was clear. The sirens had been held off for many hours just in case there was another threat, and to allow the smoke to make its way into the atmosphere. It was Bettina Steiner who noticed the small fire and the sliver of smoke farther down, close to the Umper River. It trailed into the sky, and the girl held up her finger.
Look!
The girl might have seen it first, but it was Rudy who reacted. In his haste, he did not relinquish his grip on the toolbox as he sprinted to the bottom of Himmel Street, took a few side roads, and entered the trees. Liesel was next, having surrendered her books to a heavily protesting Rosa, and then a smattering of people from several shelters along the way.
Rudy, wait!
Rudy did not wait. Liesel could only see the toolbox in certain gaps in the trees as he made his way through to the dying glow and the misty plain. It sat smoking in the clearing by the river. The pilot had tried to land there. Within 20 meters, Rudy stopped. Just as I arrived myself, I noticed him standing there, recovering his breath. The limbs of trees were scattered in the dark. There were twigs and needles littered around the plain like fire fuel. To their left, 3 gashes were burned into the earth. The runaway tick-tock of cooling metal sped up the minutes and seconds till they were standing there for what felt like hours. The growing crowd was assembling behind them, their breath and sentences sticking to Liesel's back.
"Well," said Rudy, "should we take a look?"
He stepped through the remainder of trees to where the body of the plane was fixed to the ground. Its nose was in the running water, and the wings were left crookedly behind. Rudy circled slowly from the tail and around to the right.
"There's glass," he said. "The windshield is everywhere."
Then he saw the body. Rudy Steiner had never seen a face so pale.
"Don't come, Liesel."
But Liesel came. She could see the barely conscious face of the enemy pilot as the tall trees watched and the river ran. The plane let out a few more coughs, and the head inside tilted from left to right. He said something they obviously could not understand.
"Jesus, Mary and Joseph," Rudy whispered. "He's alive."
The toolbox bumped the side of the plane and brought with it the sound of more human voices and feet. The glow of fire was gone, and the morning was still and black. Only the smoke was in its way, but it too would soon be exhausted. The wall of trees kept the color of a burning Munich at bay. By now, the boy's eyes had adjusted not only to the darkness, but to the face of the pilot. The eyes were like coffee stains, and gashes were ruled across his cheeks and chin. A ruffled uniform sat unruly across his chest. Despite Rudy's advice, Liesel came even closer, and I can promise you that we recognized each other at that exact moment. "I know you," I thought. There was a train and a coughing boy. There was snow and a distraught girl. "You've grown," I thought, "but I recognize you." She did not back away or try to fight me, but I know that something told the girl I was there. Could she smell my breath? Could she hear my cursed circular heartbeat, revolving like the crime it is in my deathly chest? I don't know, but she knew me, and she looked me in my face, and she did not look away. As the sky began to charcoal toward light, we both moved on. We both observed the boy as he reached into his toolbox again and searched through some picture frames to pull out a small, stuffed, yellow toy. Carefully, he climbed to the dying man. He placed the smiling teddy bear cautiously onto the pilot's shoulder. The tip of its ear touched his throat. The dying man breathed it in. He spoke. In English, he said,
"Thank you."
His straight-line cuts opened as he spoke, and a small drop of blood rolled crookedly down his throat.
"What?" Rudy asked him. "Was hast du gesagt? What did you say?"
Unfortunately, I beat him to the answer. The time was there, and I was reaching into the cockpit. I slowly extracted the pilot's soul from his ruffled uniform and rescued him from the broken plane. The crowd played with the silence as I made my way through. I jostled free. Above me, the sky eclipsed, just the last moment of darkness, and I swear I could see a black signature in the shape of a swastika. It loitered untidily above. "Heil Hitler," I said, but I was well into the trees by then. Behind me, a teddy bear rested on the shoulder of a corpse. A lemon candle stood below the branches. The pilot's soul was in my arms. It's probably fair to say that in all the years of Hitler's reign, no person was able to serve the Führer as loyally as me. A human doesn't have a heart like mine. A human heart is a line, whereas my own is a circle, and I have the endless ability to be in the right place at the right time. The consequence of this is that I'm always finding humans at their best and worst. I see their ugly and their beauty, and I wonder how the same thing can be both. Still, they have one thing I envy. Humans, if nothing else, have the good sense to die.
Homecoming. It was a time of bleeders and broken planes and teddy bears, but the first quarter of 1943 was to finish on a positive note for the book thief. At the beginning of April, Hans Hubermann's plaster was trimmed to the knee, and he boarded a train for Munich. He would be given a week of rest and recreation at home before joining the ranks of army pen pushers in the city. He would help with the paperwork on the clean-up of Munich's factories, houses, churches, and hospitals. Time would tell if he would be sent out to do the repair work. That all depended on his leg and the state of the city. It was dark when he arrived home. It was a day later than expected, as the train was delayed due to an air raid scare. He stood at the door of 33 Himmel Street and made a fist. 4 years earlier, Liesel Memminger was coaxed through that doorway when she showed up for the first time. Max Vandenberg had stood there with a key biting into his hand. Now it was Hans Hubermann's turn. He knocked 4 times, and the book thief answered.
"Papa! Papa!"
She must have said it 100 times as she hugged him in the kitchen and wouldn't let go. Later, after they ate, they sat at the kitchen table long into the night, and Hans told his wife and Liesel Memminger everything. He explained the LSE and the smoke-filled streets and the poor, lost, wandering souls. And Reinhold Zucker. Poor, stupid Reinhold Zucker. It took hours. At 1 a.m, Liesel went to bed, and Papa came in to sit with her, like he used to. She woke up several times to check that he was there, and he did not fail her. The night was calm. Her bed was warm and soft. With contentment. Yes, it was a great night to be Liesel Memminger, and the calm, the warm, and the soft would remain for approximately 3 more months. But her story lasts for 6. Part 10. The Book Thief. Featuring The End of a World, The 98th Day, A Warmaker, Way of the Words, A Catatonic Girl, Confessions, Ilse Hermann's Little Black Book, Some Ribcage Plains, and A Mountain Range of Rubble. The End of the World, Part 1. Again, I offer you a glimpse of the end. Perhaps it's to soften the blow for later, or to better prepare myself for the telling. Either way, I must inform you that it was raining on Himmel Street when the world ended for Liesel Memminger. The sky was dripping. Like a tap that a child has tried its hardest to turn off but hasn't quite managed. The first drops were cool. I felt them on my hands, as I stood outside Frau Diller's. Above me, I could hear them. Through the overcast sky, I looked up and saw the tin can planes. I watched their stomachs open and the bombs drop casually out. They were off target, of course. They were often off target. A small, sad hope. No one wanted to bomb Himmel Street. No one would bomb a place named after heaven, would they? Would they? The bombs came down, and soon the clouds would bake, and the cold raindrops would turn to ash. Hot snowflakes would shower to the ground. In short, Himmel Street was flattened. Houses were splashed from one side of the street to the other. A framed photo of a very serious-looking Führer was bashed and beaten on the shattered floor. Yet he smiled in that serious way of his. He knew something we all didn't know. But I knew something he didn't know. All while people slept. Rudi Steiner slept. Mama and Papa slept. Frau Holzapfel, Frau Diller, Tommy Müller. All sleeping. All dying. Only one person survived. She survived because she was sitting in a basement reading through the story of her own life, checking for mistakes. Previously, the room had been declared too shallow, but on that night, October the 7th, it was enough. The shells of wreckage cantered down, and hours later, when the strange, unkempt silence settled itself in Malking, the local LSE could hear something. An echo. Down there, somewhere, a girl was hammering a paint can with a pencil. They all stopped, with bent ears and bodies, and when they heard it again, they started digging. Passed items, hand to hand. Blocks of cement and roof tiles. A piece of wall with a dripping sun painted on it. An unhappy-looking accordion, peering through its eaten case. They threw all of it upward. When another piece of broken wall was removed, one of them saw the book thief's hair. The man had such a nice laugh. He was delivering a newborn child. I can't believe it! She's alive! There was so much joy among the cluttering, calling men, but I could not fully share their enthusiasm. Earlier, I'd held her papa in one arm and her mama in the other. Each soul was so soft. Farther away, their bodies were laid out, like the rest. Papa's lovely silver eyes were already starting to rust, and Mama's cardboard lips were fixed, half open, most likely the shape of an incomplete snore. To blaspheme like the Germans, Jesus, Mary, and Joseph. The rescuing hands pulled Liesel out and brushed the crumbs of rubble from her clothes. "Young girl," they said, "the sirens were too late. What were you doing in the basement? How did you know?" What they didn't notice was that the girl was still holding the book. She screamed her reply, a stunning scream of the living. "Papa!" A second time, her face creased as she reached a higher, more panic-stricken pitch. "Papa! Papa!" They passed her up as she shouted, wailed, and cried. If she was injured, she did not yet know it, for she struggled free and searched and called and wailed some more. She was still clutching the book. She was holding desperately onto the words who had saved her life. The 98th Day. For the first 97 days after Hans Hubermann's return in April 1943, everything was fine. On many occasions he was pensive about the thought of his son fighting in Stalingrad, but he hoped that some of his luck was in the boy's blood. On his third night at home, he played the accordion in the kitchen. A promise was a promise. There was music, soup, and jokes, and the laughter of a 14-year-old girl. "Sau Mensch!" Mama warned her. "Stop laughing so loud! His jokes aren't that funny, and they're filthy, too!" After a week, Hans resumed his service, travelling into the city to one of the army offices. He said that there was a good supply of cigarettes and food there, and sometimes he was able to bring home some cookies or extra jam. It was like the good old days. A minor air raid in May, a Heil Hitler here or there, and everything was fine. Until the 98th day. A small statement by an old woman. On Munich Street, she said,
"Jesus, Mary and Joseph, I wish they wouldn't bring them through, these wretched Jews. They're rotten luck. They're a bad sign. Every time I see them, I know we'll be ruined."
It was the same old lady who announced the Jews the first time Liesl saw them. On ground level, her face was a prune. Her eyes were the dark blue of a vein. And her prediction was accurate. In the heart of summer, Molking was delivered a sign of things to come. It moved into sight like it always did. First the bobbing head of a soldier and the gun poking at the air above him. Then the ragged chain of clinking Jews. The only difference this time was that they were brought from the opposite direction. They were taken through to the neighbouring town of Nebling to scrub the streets and do the clean-up work that the army refused to do. Late in the day, they were marched back to camp, slow and tired, defeated. Again, Liesl searched for Max Vandenberg, thinking that he could easily have ended up in Dachau without being marched through Molking. He was not there. Not on this occasion. Just give it time, though. For on a warm afternoon in August, Max would most certainly be marched through town with the rest of them. Unlike the others, however, he would not watch the road. He would not look randomly into the Führer's German grandstand. A fact regarding Max Vandenberg. He would search the faces on Munich Street for a book-thieving girl. On this occasion, in July, on what Liesl later calculated as the 98th day of her papa's return, she stood and studied the moving pile of mournful Jews, looking for Max. If nothing else, it alleviated the pain of simply watching. "That's a horrible thought," she would write in her Himmel Street basement. But she knew it to be true. The pain of watching them? What about their pain? The pain of stumbling shoes and torment and the closing gates of the camp. They came through twice in 10 days, and soon after, the anonymous, prune-faced woman on Munich Street was proven absolutely correct. Suffering had most definitely come, and if they could blame the Jews as a warning or prologue, they should have blamed the Führer and his quest for Russia as the actual cause. For when Himmel Street woke later in July, a returned soldier was discovered to be dead. He was hanging from one of the rafters in a laundry up near Frau Diller's. Another human pendulum, another clock, stopped. The careless owner had left the door open. July the 24th, 6:03 a.m. The laundry was warm, the rafters were firm, and Michael Holzapfel jumped from the chair as if it were a cliff. "So many people chased after me in that time, calling my name, asking me to take them with me. Then there was the small percentage who called me casually over and whispered with their tightened voices. 'Have me,' they said, and there was no stopping them. They were frightened, no question, but they were not afraid of me. It was a fear of messing up and having to face themselves again, and facing the world, and the likes of you. There was nothing I could do. They had too many ways. They were too resourceful. And when they did it too well, whatever their chosen method, I was in no position to refuse." Michael Holzapfel knew what he was doing. He killed himself for wanting to live. Of course, I did not see Liesl Memminger at all that day. As is usually the case, I advised myself that I was far too busy to remain on Himmel Street to listen to the screams. It's bad enough when people catch me red-handed, so I made the usual decision to make my exit into the breakfast-coloured sun. I did not hear the detonation of an old man's voice when he found the hanging body, nor the sound of running feet and jaw-dropped gasps when other people arrived.
I did not hear a skinny man with a moustache mutter, "Crying shame, a damn shame." I did not see Frau Holzapfel, laid out flat on Himmel Street, her arms out wide, her screaming face in total despair. No, I didn't discover any of that until I came back a few months later and read something called The Book Thief. It was explained to me that in the end, Michael Holzapfel was worn down not by his damaged hand or any other injury, but by the guilt of living. In the lead-up to his death, the girl had realized that he wasn't sleeping, that each night was like poison. I often imagine him lying awake, sweating in sheets of snow, or seeing visions of his brother's severed legs. Liesel wrote that sometimes she almost told him about her own brother, like she did with Max. But there seemed a big difference between a long-distance cough and two obliterated legs. How do you console a man who has seen such things? Could you tell him the Führer was proud of him, that the Führer loved him for what he did in Stalingrad? How could you even dare? You can only let him do the talking. The dilemma, of course, is that such people save their most important words for after, when the surrounding humans are unlucky enough to find them. A note, a sentence, even a question, or a letter, like on Himmel Street in July 1943. Michael Holzapfel, the last goodbye.
Dear Mama, can you ever forgive me? I just couldn't stand it any longer. I'm meeting Robert. I don't care what the damn Catholics say about it. There must be a place in heaven for those who have been where I have been. You might think I don't love you because of what I've done, but I do. Your Michael.
It was Hans Hubermann who was asked to give Frau Holzapfel the news. He stood on her threshold, and she must have seen it on his face. Two sons in 6 months. The morning sky stood blazing behind him as the wiry woman made her way past. She ran sobbing to the gathering farther up on Himmel Street. She said the name Michael at least 24 times, but Michael had already answered. According to the book thief, Frau Holzapfel hugged the body for nearly an hour. She then returned to the blinding sun of Himmel Street and sat herself down. She could no longer walk. From a distance, people observed. Such a thing was easier from far away. Hans Hubermann sat with her. He placed his hand on hers, as she fell back to the hard ground. He allowed her screams to fill the street. Much later, Hans walked with her with painstaking care through her front gate and into the house. And no matter how many times I try to see it differently, I can't pull it off. When I imagine that scene of the distraught woman and the tall, silver-eyed man, it is still snowing in the kitchen of 31 Himmel Street. The War Maker. There was the smell of a freshly cut coffin, black dresses, enormous suitcases under the eyes. Liesel stood like the rest on the grass. She read to Frau Holzapfel that same afternoon. The Dream Carrier, her neighbor's favorite. It was a busy day all around, really. July the 27th, 1943. Michael Holzapfel was buried, and the book thief read to the bereaved. The Allies bombed Hamburg. And on that subject, it's lucky I'm somewhat miraculous. No one else could carry close to 45,000 people in such a short amount of time. Not in a million human years. The Germans were starting to pay in earnest by then. The Führer's pimply little knees were starting to shake. Still, I'll give him something, that Führer. He certainly had an iron will. There was no slackening off in terms of war-making, nor was there any scaling back on the extermination and punishment of a Jewish plague. While most of the camps were spread throughout Europe, there were some still in existence in Germany itself. In those camps, many people were still made to work and walk. Max Vandenberg was one such Jew. Way of the Words. It happened in a small town of Hitler's heartland. The flow of more suffering was pumped nicely out, and a small piece of it had now arrived. Jews were being marched through the outskirts of Munich, and one teenage girl somehow did the unthinkable and made her way through to walk with them. When the soldiers pulled her away and threw her to the ground, she stood up again. She continued. The morning was warm. Another beautiful day for a parade. The soldiers and Jews made their way through several towns, and were arriving now in Malking. It was possible that more work needed to be done in the camp, or several prisoners had died. Whatever the reason, a new batch of fresh, tired Jews was being taken on foot to Dachau. As she always did, Liesel ran to Munich Street, with the usual band of onlookers. "Heil Hitler!" She could hear the first soldier from far up the road, and made her way toward him through the crowd to meet the procession. The voice amazed her. It made the endless sky into a ceiling just above his head, and the words bounced back, landing somewhere on the floor of limping Jewish feet. Their eyes. They watched the moving street, one by one, and when Liesel found a good vantage point, she stopped and studied them. She raced through the files of face after face, trying to match them to the Jew who wrote The Standover Man and The Word Shaker. Feathery hair, she thought. No, hair like twigs. That's what it looks like when it hasn't been washed. Look out for hair like twigs and swampy eyes and a kindling beard. God, there were so many of them. So many sets of dying eyes and scuffing feet. Liesel searched them, and it was not so much a recognition of facial features that gave Max Vandenberg away. It was how the face was acting, also studying the crowd, fixed in concentration. Liesel felt herself pausing as she found the only face looking directly into the German spectators. It examined them with such purpose that people on either side of the book thief noticed and pointed him out.
"What's he looking at?" said a male voice at her side.
The book thief stepped onto the road. Never had movement been such a burden. Never had a heart been so definite and big in her adolescent chest. She stepped forward and said, very quietly, "He's looking for me." Her voice trailed off and fell away inside. She had to re-find it, reaching far down to learn to speak again and call out his name. Max.
"I'm here, Max."
Louder.
"Max, I'm here."
He heard her. Max Vandenberg, August 1943. There were twigs of hair, just like Liesel thought, and the swampy eyes stepped across, shoulder to shoulder over the other Jews. When they reached her, they pleaded. His beard stroked down his face, and his mouth shivered as he said the word, the name, the girl. Liesel. Liesel shrugged away entirely from the crowd, and entered the tide of Jews, weaving through them till she grabbed hold of his arm with her left hand. His face fell on her. It reached down as she tripped, and the Jew, the nasty Jew, helped her up. It took all of his strength.
"I'm here, Max," she said again. "I'm here."
"I can't believe." The words dripped from Max Vandenberg's mouth. "Look how much you've grown." There was an intense sadness in his eyes. They swelled. "Liesel, they got me a few months ago." The voice was crippled, but it dragged itself toward her. "Halfway to Stuttgart." From the inside, the stream of Jews was a murky disaster of arms and legs, ragged uniforms. No soldier had seen her yet, and Max gave her a warning.
"You have to let go of me, Liesel."
He even tried to push her away, but the girl was too strong. Max's starving arms could not sway her, and she walked on between the filth, the hunger, and confusion. After a long line of steps, the first soldier noticed.
"Hey!" he called in. He pointed with his whip. "Hey, girl! What are you doing? Get out of there!"
When she ignored him completely, the soldier used his arm to separate the stickiness of people. He shoved them aside and made his way through. He loomed above her as Liesel struggled on and noticed the strangled expression on Max Vandenberg's face. She had seen him afraid, but never like this. The soldier took her. His hands manhandled her clothes. She could feel the bones in his fingers and the ball of each knuckle. They tore at her skin.
"I said get out!"
he ordered her. And now he dragged the girl to the side and flung her into the wall of onlooking Germans. It was getting warmer. The sun burned her face. The girl had landed sprawling with pain, but now she stood again. She recovered and waited. She re-entered. This time Liesel made her way through from the back. Ahead, she could just see the distinct twigs of hair and walked again toward them. This time she did not reach out. She stopped. Somewhere inside her were the souls of words. They climbed out and stood beside her.
"Max,"
she said. He turned and briefly closed his eyes as the girl continued.
"There was once a strange small man," she said.
Her arms were loose, but her hands were fists at her side.
"But there was a word shaker, too."
One of the Jews on his way to Dachau had stopped walking now. He stood absolutely still as the others swerved morosely around him, leaving him completely alone. His eyes staggered, and it was so simple. The words were given across from the girl to the Jew. They climbed onto him. The next time she spoke, the question stumbled from her mouth. Hot tears fought for room in her eyes as she would not let them out. Better to stand resolute and proud, let the words do all of it.
"Is it really you?" the young man asked, she said. "Is it from your cheek that I took the seed?"
Max Vandenberg remained standing. He did not drop to his knees. People and Jews and clouds all stopped. They watched. As he stood, Max looked first at the girl and then stared directly into the sky, who was wide and blue and magnificent. There were heavy beams, planks of sun, falling randomly, wonderfully to the road. Clouds arched their backs to look behind as they started again to move on.
"It's such a beautiful day," he said,
and his voice was in many pieces. "A great day to die. A great day to die like this." Liesel walked at him. She was courageous enough to reach out and hold his bearded face.
"Is it really you, Max?"
Such a brilliant German day, and its attentive crowd. He let his mouth kiss her palm.
"Yes, Liesel, it's me."
And he held the girl's hand in his face and cried onto her fingers. He cried as the soldiers came and a small collection of insolent Jews stood and watched. Standing, he was whipped.
"Max,"
the girl wept. Then silently, as she was dragged away, "Max, Jewish fist fighter." Inside, she said all of it. "Maxi Taxi. That's what that friend called you in Stuttgart when you fought on the street, remember? Remember, Max, you told me. I remember everything. That was you, the boy with the hard fists, and you said you would land a punch on Death's face when he came for you. Remember the snowman, Max? Remember? In the basement? Remember the white cloud with the grey heart? The Führer still comes down looking for you sometimes. He misses you. We all miss you." The whip. The whip. The whip continued from the soldier's hand. It landed on Max's face. It clipped his chin and carved his throat. Max hit the ground, and the soldier now turned to the girl. His mouth opened. He had immaculate teeth. A sudden flash came before her eyes. She recalled the day she'd wanted Ilse Hermann, or at least the reliable Rosa, to slap her, but neither of them would do it. On this occasion, she was not let down. The whip sliced her collarbone and reached across her shoulder blade.
"Liesel!"
She knew that person. As the soldier swung his arm, she caught sight of